Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 2013 was another big year in the USA for outbreaks of measles, whooping cough, and other preventable diseases. Illnesses that the Centers for Disease Control thought they had in check decades ago. Epidemiologists say that much of the rise and return of these disease outbreaks is linked to a growing U.S. population that is choosing not to vaccinate its children. Faced with more illness, some states are now pushing back. Colorado is trying to make it harder for parents to exempt their children from vaccination. Washington and Oregon have already acted. This hour on Point, the vaccine debate and the return of preventable contagious diseases. We're going to go first to Colorado today, which is in the middle of this debate right now. Joining us from Denver is Michael Booth, health and medical reporter for the Denver Post. He's been covering the pushback in Colorado against the anti-vaccine movement. Michael Booth, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
What is Colorado proposing and why, Michael?
Colorado has gone at this on a couple of fronts right now. We did this about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, where they saw that flu obviously is a big problem every year in every state, and they went after it by saying that up to, in this following year, 90% of people who come in contact with people at health facilities, whether it's a hospital or a nursing home, across the board have to be immunized. And there was some controversy about that. Some nurses and other people who work in those settings did not like being told what they had to do in order to keep their job. But Colorado was pushing ahead on that and saying it's been clear that people vaccinated against flu viruses every year are of much better protection for public health, and that in public health situations and medical situations, those are the very people who should understand that, and those employees should be immunized. Now, since then, we have continued to have outbreaks of pertussis, whooping cough in Colorado and many other states, major spikes in that in the last couple of years. And now, as you've seen and as you mentioned, measles outbreaks that are very worrisome to people because measles was one that was really supposed to have been conquered some time ago. So in Colorado now and some other states, there is talk of tightening up this the form that people have that they can, when their kids go to school, say that they don't want vaccinations and their kids are exempt from it. It's a very simple process in Colorado. You just sign a form that says you have some personal objection. It could be religious. It could really just say, personally, I disagree with it or I don't like it.
Okay.
And your kids are still allowed to go to public school.
Yeah.
And so the way that Colorado and other states are going about it is talking about what can we do to make that system more difficult. If 5 to 6% of kids are showing up at school without proper vaccinations and getting these exemptions, that's when you start getting into this problem of that's not full herd immunity. That's not enough people to protect us from future outbreaks. So how can we make it, inform those parents and make it more difficult for them to just opt out? And one way to do that is to make it sort of a, my phrase has been informed dissent, so that before you make that dissent from what the customary practice is, you have to go through an education process so that you would have a doctor or a public health person, a nurse, would sit down with you and explain to you why public health officials believe that vaccination is important, how it protects the general public and protects your own child, and then you could sign the form, but you would have to go through that education process first.
What is the rate of vaccination at this point for some of these major vaccines? I'm looking at a map of the country here, and Colorado is among those with the highest levels of unvaccinated children, along with you got Vermont and Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Colorado, Arizona, and then up in the northwest corner, Idaho, Oregon, Washington. Some of these getting up to 4, 5, 6% and higher of children not vaccinated. Where's Colorado stand, Michael?
That's the map that you don't want to stand out on, but we do in Colorado, and as is, you mentioned, some of the other states. So depending on which study you're looking at, somewhere between about 5 and 6% of people, of students, are coming in with the exemption and without the proper vaccinations, or at least without the proper proof that they've received all the vaccinations on the schedule that public health officials want them to have. Now, 5 or 6% may not sound like that much. You might say, well, 95% of anything must be some kind of public policy success. But the way it works in epidemiology and in medicine is that people come in contact with so many other people that one person or that small group of people makes a big difference in things like vaccinations and these kinds of highly communicable illnesses.
So what is it, do you think, in, take your state, Colorado, what is it either in the public discourse or in your culture or in the leanings of people sociologically that's put Colorado up near the highest percentage of unvaccinated kids?
So we talked to many people and talked to many doctors and nurses who talk to a lot of people. They're the ones meeting the parents and the kids on the front lines coming in and hearing what their objections are or what their thinking is. And it's not just one group of people or one political or social ideology that you're talking about. I think that people often assume that it's people who are very distrustful of the government, maybe from a conservative point of view, more libertarian, who might consider homeschooling their kids, do not want to be involved in all of the public schedules of everything that they feel is required of them. And that there certainly is that group of people in Colorado and in some of the other states. But there's also in Colorado a significant group of people who might have a more left-leaning ideology, who are very well informed, who have thought about things like genetically modified foods or what they're putting in their bodies in other ways, and they have decided that they feel that there are risks to vaccinations, that they might decide to expose their children to, that it's better to expose their children to the diseases that are out there and the germs that are out there and have them build up their own immunities. And what drives doctors and nurses crazy about this is that they're often latching on to old and very discredited information about dangers of the vaccines themselves and of the immunization process themselves. There was a study that was done that claimed that there might be a link between the increase in reports of autism in kids to vaccinations, and that has been thoroughly discredited over and over again since then. But doctors tell us many times that what they hear very frequently as parents come in is that particular study. It sticks in people's heads, and they're trying to figure out how to change that dialogue.
Do you have a sense of where people are on the economic ladder who are resisting this in Colorado? I mean, I'm looking at stories from around the country, but here's one that says this is in some very affluent areas you've got resistance. Malibu, public, only 58% of students, in one public elementary school in Malibu, only 58% immunized. At very expensive private schools in Los Angeles, where only 20% of children are now vaccinated. These are hyper-affluent zones.
Sure. Happens in Boulder, Colorado, also affluent area, highly educated area. And I'm sure you would find that reflected in other cities that you would not be your first candidate in the other states that are highlighted on this map. So I don't think that there is just the one pattern. Economically, another aspect of this is that there really shouldn't be much of an economic reason in terms of whether it's affordable or not to avoid vaccinations. There are so many, we have pushed now school clinics so deep into the process of medicine and healthcare in America, both through things like private health foundations in Colorado and other states. Obamacare put a lot of money into bolstering school clinics, and now there are a lot of communities where not just the students but their families are getting a significant amount of their health care through the schools. And that's a great way for public health officials to make contact and give out free or reduced price vaccinations and try to figure out if the people they're seeing have the full schedule. So there is an infrastructure available to make sure that this push can happen. Now you've got to deal with the laws and the rules that are in place that make it very too easy for people to back out.
I want to get a sense of the public debate over this there. We've got a little tape here. Your Department of Public Health and Environment in Colorado now wanting to require parents to receive this counseling on vaccination before they can opt out for non-medical reasons. Here's some tape from Colorado Public Radio of Teresa Wrangham, Executive Director of the National Vaccine Information Center. It's an anti-vaccine group opposed to the requirement, here talking with Colorado Public Radio.
I think it's a bit arrogant, actually, to say, for those of you who don't agree with the public health agenda, and who seek exemption, we're going to require that you get extra education because obviously you're missing the boat here.
Arrogant, she says. What has the public reaction been to this push for these parents to get a little more information before they sign the exemption and opt out?
There will always be pushback on this when the government comes through and says, we think it's important that you do something, and now we're going to make it even more of a requirement, or we're going to make it a higher penalty if you don't do it. There will always be the pushback that it's government arrogance, that they shouldn't have to tell me what to do. They are assuming they know better than I do when it's my children, and that's certainly understandable. But on the other hand, I think that some public health officials are feeling their muscles a little bit more in terms of dealing with these problems. They're not just going to sit back and let the problem get worse. They're taking steps like requiring the health workers to get flu vaccines, and now they're considering this step in Colorado and other states and saying, we understand, but the whole point of public health is to protect the public. When the public doesn't always understand the situation or have time to deal with it, they sometimes have to follow mandates when the mandates have been proven to improve the overall health of the population.
And Michael, very briefly, we're up against the clock here, but what about parents who have had their children vaccinated, but nevertheless are living in communities at more risk here? How are they speaking out or not on this?
You do get quite a bit of commentary from people saying, what are you doing? You need to do this. You, my neighbor, need to do this in order to protect all of us, and you're putting my children at risk if you choose not to do this. So we will see as this moves forward in Colorado. It can either be done in the legislature, it may be done in the state department's board, public health board that may make the decision on their own. We'll see how much pushback there is, but there will be testimony from many people who say, we do agree with this and we do want to see our children protected as well.
Michael Booth with the Denver Post in Denver, Colorado. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael.
Thanks for your time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about states pushing back on the anti-vaccine movement as the country faces more outbreaks of preventable communicable disease. But there's been a lot of concern and worry out there for years now about these vaccines. Scientists say disproven claims, but it's out in the culture and it's having its effect. There was the story of the televangelist Kenneth Copeland in Texas warning parents and his congregation and beyond that they should consider all their options before vaccination of their children. In 2013, his church, the Eagle Mountain International Church in Newark, Texas, was the site of a measles outbreak. Here he is back in 2010. This message of kind of discouragement or else looked at your options on vaccination. 2010, Kenneth Copeland.
As parents, we need to be a whole lot more serious about this in being aware of what is good and what isn't. And you don't take the word of the guy that's trying to give the shot about what's good and what isn't.
Well, be careful. In last August, Pastor Terry Pearson addressed the Eagle Mountain International Church there in Newark, Texas. After that church, Kenneth Copeland's church was linked to 21 cases of measles. She said the church will now offer vaccinations, but if people don't want to get them because they feel God will protect them, they don't have to.
There will be measles vaccination clinic here on Friday. I would encourage you to do that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. And go do it. Go do it. And go in faith. Don't do anything you don't do in faith.
When the measles hit, minds can change. And that and more are hitting, spiking in areas around the country. We go down to two doctors concerned about where a decade and more of anti-vaccine questions and campaigning are pushing our vulnerability to preventable communicable disease. From Baltimore, Stephen Salzberg joins us, professor of medicine and biostatistics at Johns Hopkins University. He blogs about science and medicine for Forbes. Stephen Salzberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. And from Philadelphia, Paul Offit joins us. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Paul Offit is co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, recommended for universal use in infants by the CDC. Paul Offit, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Salzberg, look across the map of the country at where the opt-out movement is strongest and where now the push-back movement is the strongest. States saying, wait a minute, we've got to do something here. We can't let our vaccination rates run too low.
Well, I'm glad to see the states finally doing this. In a way, as I've written about and as Dr. Offit has written before, the very success of the vaccine programs over the past few decades has led to the rise of this anti-vaccine movement. One of the problems is that people simply don't see many of the infectious diseases that used to be common in the U.S., and so they're not worried about them. So even a tiny hint of some risk, whether it's based in science or just rumor, is enough to people say, oh, you know, I think I'll just opt out of that. And so states over the past 10 or 20 years have allowed these exemptions to sort of creep in and made them easier and easier for people to adopt. So I'm glad to see they're finally pushing back because we're now, and it's happening in part because we're now seeing these outbreaks and people are starting to get worried again about these very, very real risks of infectious diseases.
Paul Offit, how do the emerging low vaccination rates that we're now looking at compare with what this country had historically when instances of these disease were low?
Right. So I mean, what you're seeing actually is exactly what you would expect to see, which is that as you mentioned earlier, herd immunity is key. And when you start to see an erosion in vaccine immunization rates, as we're seeing now, and it's not that big. I mean, if you look, for example, Colorado has about 4%. Of children in that state are not getting vaccines for so-called non-medical exemptions, meaning philosophical or religious exemptions. That's enough to start seeing diseases that are highly contagious come back, diseases like measles, whooping cough, mumps. That's exactly what you would expect to see happen as there's an erosion in these rates. And, you know, you would have to have a further erosion in rates to see other diseases come back, diseases like polio or diphtheria, which aren't quite as contagious as these. And maybe if they came back, we'd be even more moved by everything that's going on, because I think polio and diphtheria are probably seen as more emotional diseases. And if you take measles, for example, we had around 200 cases or so of measles last year, which is certainly the biggest epidemic we've had of measles in a fairly long time, at least in sort of the 10-year range. But before there was a measles vaccine, we'd have 3 to 4 million cases, 100,000 hospitalizations, and 500 to 1,000 deaths. We didn't have any deaths last year from measles, and maybe that would change things. I think if we had a death or two of measles, and that would probably happen when we get up to around 600 cases, then maybe we would change. But it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch us not learn from history.
I want to look at the claims and trends that have led to this lower rate of vaccination. We'll do that in this hour, but I definitely want to hear from people who are carrying these concerns and hear the responses of you, Stephen, and you, Dr. Offit. Alice in Beaufort, South Carolina, thank you for calling. Alice, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
Well, I guess I wanted to first state that I am not anti-vaccine. I'm against the over-vaccination of children in this country. To set the stage. And secondly, I am a very well-educated individual, so I'm part of that community that is higher educated, more affluent, that has chosen not to vaccinate my little boy.
Okay.
After he became clearly getting impacted by these vaccines. But I think the hardest thing that hit me was when a pediatrician sat across from me and said to me, I'm sorry, but some children must be sacrificed for the better of the community, for the rest of the community. And I looked him straight in the eye and said, you're telling me that face-to-face and you have children? Then you sacrifice your children because you just told me the risks are high enough for me to say no, thank you.
Paul Offit, if you would be good enough, enter the conversation here with Alice. You hear some of her experience here and what she's taking from it. What do you say?
Children aren't over-vaccinated. I mean, when vaccines come onto the market, they have to be tested in so-called concomitant use studies to make sure that the vaccine that's added doesn't interfere with the safety profile or immunogenicity profile of existing vaccines and vice versa. These vaccines are well tested and well tolerated. I think the question that the caller raised is what are the side effects and are they serious? And certainly vaccines do have side effects, but those side effects are pain and redness at the injection site. Some vaccines contain gelatin, which can cause an allergic reaction and very, very rarely a severe allergic reaction. Some people are allergic to the egg proteins contained in the flu vaccines. But For the most part, that's about it. I mean, you know, vaccines don't cause permanent harm. Children aren't being sacrificed by vaccines. Quite the opposite. I think a parent's most important job is to put children in the safest position possible, and that's what vaccines do.
So, Alice, what was your pediatrician talking about when he said, you know, some children have to be sacrificed for the good of the greater number, I guess?
Well, I brought in a binder that I have been collecting over the years with study after study after study that showed that there is some issue with vaccinating and over-vaccinating our kids, and that there are more than just allergic reactions to these particular injections and the multi-injections and the immunosuppression that happens the minute these kids get jammed with four different germs. And I looked at him and said, how can you look at this data that I have in front of you and tell me that it's okay, that I should be, it's safe? And that's when he realized he had no debate. And honestly, show me a double-blind study of vaccinated children versus non-vaccinated children, and then I will talk more about vaccinating at the level the CDC is pushing, which I find ironic that a friend of mine who works at the CDC has a friend on the committee of the vaccine committee for the CDC who doesn't vaccinate his own children.
Alice, stand by again. Stephen Salzberg, first of all, speak to that binder that Alice brought in. People can grab onto lots of material these days. What about the likely contents of that binder? And Alice's assertion as we speak today that she doesn't see the proof that persuades her.
Well, I of course, don't know exactly what studies are in her binder, but I've read many studies, certainly dozens, if not hundreds of studies myself, looking at various issues of vaccine efficacy and safety, as I've written about this and done research on this over the years. And I have not seen a single well-done study that shows any sort of long-term damage caused by vaccines, as Dr. Offa just said. There were a number of claims made, and there are actually some very poorly done studies that were later debunked or refuted that seem to show a link between vaccines and certain harms. But science kind of moves and fits and starts, and it's difficult for, I think, understandably difficult for someone who's not a scientist to make sense of it. But when you look at the scientific literature and you read things as they're sort of carefully worded, you see the evidence is very clear and unequivocal that vaccines provide a tremendous benefit. And as Dr. Offit said, the only documented risk is really just sort of localized pain and swelling for a short term and very little chance of anything other than that. So if I were, you know, in the room with her, I would say, well, let me see those studies. And if you want, we can spend some time and look at them and see if they really are saying what you've been told or what you've interpreted them as saying. I don't know what her pediatrician thought, but I was kind of appalled to hear that her pediatrician told her that she should sacrifice her children for the greater good. That's not what vaccines are about. They're about protecting your children as well as protecting all the other people in the community.
Dr. Offit, you spend a lot of time with this. What do you think it's going to take to persuade someone like Alice? And should she be persuaded already that the clear evidence of safety is out there?
I think anyone who looks at the studies regarding safety of vaccines would be persuaded. I mean, I think that it's certainly understandable how parents can raise the question. You know, my child was fine; they got a vaccine. Now they have asthma or autism or attention deficit disorder or hyperactivity. Could the vaccine have done that? And the good news is that's an answerable question. In a scientific venue, you can answer that question by doing the right kinds of study. And for the most part, those concerns have been addressed. That's probably most thoroughly the autism concern, and vaccines don't cause those problems. So I think if you look at the data, you would be convinced. I would argue that I'm fairly well informed about these data. Both of my children are fully vaccinated, so I think it's easy. But again, I think there are those who choose to believe that vaccines are harmful, and I think there's no amount of data in some cases that will convince parents otherwise because they have a belief system that's frankly not grounded in evidence.
What happened in our media or our culture to put this belief out there if it is so unfounded? I mean, here's the sound of a little of it, but I want you two to respond. This goes back to 08. This is Jenny McCarthy, actress, model, talking with CNN about her belief about her son's autism and vaccination.
So you ask any mother in the autism community if we'll take the flu, the measles, over autism any frickin' day of the week. So I think they need to wake up and stop hurting our kids. And we're not telling people not to vaccinate. I don't understand why it's so freaking hard to comprehend we deserve safe shots and a safer schedule.
Steven Salzberg, what happened here to make that message so prominent in our culture, so prominent that I look at this map of the country and you've got lots of states where vaccination levels are just plummeting?
Well, Jenny McCarthy is a celebrity, and she has been on major media talk shows on television many, many times pushing this message. And she's one of the leaders of a group called Generation Rescue, whose primary agenda is to spread the word that vaccines cause autism or vaccines cause other things, despite the fact that there's no evidence to support them. So unfortunately, in our culture, people who are celebrities are influential about issues where they're really not informed, and very influential. And so people like me or like Dr. Offit, we do our best to try to spread the word that, look, we're doing the science as carefully as we can, and looking at the evidence, we don't see any harm. And when claims come up, and she's particularly referring to the claim that vaccines cause autism, that claim was studied exhaustively after a now retracted and widely discredited study published in 1998 by a guy named Andrew Wakefield in the UK that claimed it was actually a tiny study of only 11 or 12 kids that claimed that they all came down with autism soon after getting the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. That study has been, there have been many more studies looking exactly at that connection from every possible angle, and involving not a dozen kids, but hundreds of thousands of children, showing no link whatsoever. And it also came out later that Andrew Wakefield was being paid by a group of lawyers who were trying to build a case to sue the vaccine manufacturer. So he was terribly conflicted. And in fact, his own co-authors didn't know about that. And when that all came unraveled, he lost his medical license, the paper was retracted, and he was thoroughly discredited. But despite that, belief or rumor has been picked up by celebrities and continues to be spread without any further evidence. So, you know, it was one paper 15 years ago, but very long-term lasting damage.
And we're looking at the map of that impact right now. Some states pushing back. Jay in Nashville, Tennessee. Jay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a pediatrician. I was in private practice for 12 years, and I'm now working in a pediatric emergency department. And there's three points I wanted to make. The first point is that we are, as physicians and healthcare workers, are trying to use logic to convince people who are making decisions based on emotions. And the chances of doing of succeeding is very low. So I think we have to keep that in mind, that people are using emotions and not using logic to make their decisions on this. The second point is, if I have a child, especially under 1 year of age, who has fever and I can't find a source and they're not vaccinated, I will tell the parents, this child, your child, is going to get more procedures and more things done to them because I'm very worried about vaccine preventable illnesses that your child might have, which will potentially kill your child. And so they are putting their child at risk in that regard. The third thing is, and I think this is really important, the community as a whole and parents want a 100% guarantee that something I do to their child, in this case vaccines, is safe. And as physicians and as healthcare workers, we understand that there's no way for me to guarantee that anything I do is 100% safe. I can tell you if something is going to cause harm or what the risk factor is for that harm, but I can never guarantee that anything that I do is 100% safe.
Hey, Jay, we're up against a break, but in a word, if we don't turn this around, are we in trouble in terms of infectious disease? You're a doctor on the front line.
The pendulum is going to swing back. Unfortunately, what's going to happen is people are going to get sick and going to die, and enough of them are going to that's going to happen to enough people that the vaccine profile and the is going to go back.
We'll come back. Jay in Nashville, thanks for your call. We're looking at states pushing back on the anti-vaccine movement. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about states now pushing back on the anti-vaccine movement as the country faces more outbreaks of preventable, communicable disease. And let's go to Kylia in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Kylia, you're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a parent I have a almost 40-year-old and a 17-year-old, and I've not vaccinated either one of them. I'm well-educated, probably upper middle class. Here I live in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things, there's some things that we're not talking about, and I've done it as a very well-informed and well-educated. I work with a lot of, I'm a holistic practitioner, so I work with doctors who are more holistic, functional medicine doctors, holistic pediatricians, and so that's the world that I also have a sister who's a conventional family practice physician who I consult with and from time to time.
So what do you hope or expect will protect or did protect your kids from measles, mumps, whooping cough, or God forbid if things get bad again, yeah, polio and the rest? What's
well,
your plan?
Here's the thing that's not being addressed, and is that one of the things that I knew that I made when I made a choice to not vaccinate is that I also made a choice to nourish my kids really, really well. We make very conscious choices about the foods that we eat. We use herbs and homeopathy and supplements to build our immune system. So one of the things that's not being talked about is that you have to make a conscious, I work with parents and adults. I also help them realize that it's not just a choice about not vaccinating. It's a conscious choice about nourishing our kids physically, emotionally, and spiritually.
Paul Offit, pick it up right there. Stand by, Kalisha. Do it with nourishment and herbs and build the immune system. Dr. Offit, what do you say?
Well, certainly it's important to have good nutrition, but good nutrition cannot provide specific immunity to bacteria and viruses. I mean, there's only two ways that's going to happen. One is to be naturally infected, which comes with the potential price of being permanently harmed or killed, or two, to be immunized. Those are your choices. I mean, Kalisha was lucky. She was lucky that her 40-year-old and 17-year-old didn't get any of these infections. But because I can tell you, working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, every year we see children come into this hospital who suffer and occasionally die from diseases like influenza, and invariably those children weren't immunized. Invariably, the parent made a choice not to immunize those children, and every time they're just horrified. Obviously, the worst thing in the world has happened to them, and they say, "I can't believe this happened to me." And they become invariably members of activist groups to try and inform parents about the importance of these diseases and the importance of vaccines to prevent them. But you know, you'd like to think it wouldn't come to that parents would know about these diseases and the importance of vaccines, and they wouldn't have to potentially put their children in harm's way.
But look at the map. I mean, a lot of people are opting out, and they're in places like we said, Malibu, Boulder. These are sort of, you know, with respect, health nut kind of communities, very affluent, often well educated, and they're deciding not to do it. If we get, I don't know, 10% of the national population taking Kalisha's view, will we be on a path toward, you know, wonderful super immune systems from great herbal and nutrition and all the rest, or will we be in trouble, Paul Offit?
I think we're already in trouble. I mean, at immunization rates of we're about, you know, 4 or 5% of the state's children not getting vaccines, you're already starting to see outbreaks, the likes of which we haven't seen recently. I mean, California in 2010 suffered a whooping cough outbreak that was bigger than anything we've seen in 50 years. That's remarkable. It's around the time the pertussis vaccine was invented. So we're starting to regress. And I think, you know, maybe what we're seeing, and I'm not sure, I'm just guessing, is that this is the natural history of an immunization program, that as Dr. Salzberg referred to this earlier, vaccines are at some level a victim of their own success, that we're compelled by our fears, which is what that pediatrician Jay had said. We're compelled by fear far more than reason. When we don't really see these diseases as much today, therefore we're not as compelled by them, and therefore we're not as quick to get vaccines. And so now you're starting to see outbreaks. And with those outbreaks, you're starting to see pushback. And that's good. I think we're starting to see pushback, and I think there will be probably an enhanced view to that we need to get vaccines, and that then these diseases will die down again until the next cycle. And maybe we'll just be looking at these cycles, you know, ad infinitum.
Wow. Kailia, I respect your goodwill, but what if that perspective leads us to, I mean, we are seeing now in this country big spikes of disease, and with that comes death.
Here's the thing, Tom. One of the things that also is not being talked about, which I would highly recommend, is that we all work together. There's this new, you know, program to sort of fear parents, to, you know, put the fear of medicine and death into them to force them to have to vaccinate their children. How about trying a different tactic? And like that one, you know, the one woman who called her pediatrician said, well, you'll have to sacrifice. And one of your doctors said, well, I would actually like to sit down and look at those studies. How about sitting down and working together with holistic doctors, with parents, and say, okay, how did we get here? And how can we work together?
I mean, maybe it's time for that. I hear you. Maybe it's time for that. But what about on the other side of the coin? I mean, the vaccination program itself was the manifestation of a community, a national community working together. And you're opting out of that communal effort, Kalia.
That's right. I'm a part of another community that's really talking about nourishing our innate.
But it's not another community. It's in the big community where we have outbreaks of disease because the vaccination is not there.
That's true. And both of my children have not been vaccinated. And they both had chicken pox. I had mumps and measles as a child and survived unharmed. And so, I breastfed them. I passed that on to them. And they've been very, very healthy. Not one of them have been sick.
Kalia, good luck. I wish you good luck with that. I have more callers, but I appreciate your perspective and your call. David in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air, David. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was the youngest of four children, and I have had no diseases because my mother both my parents chose to have me vaccinated. My siblings all had chickenpox. They were all laid up in the house for a week or 2 weeks, and my parents said that the children are miserable, just constantly itching and scratching, and the rash was terrible. And even when I was a kid in school, at one point I saw maybe just throughout the entire year, all of my other classmates were out of school for about a week or two because they'd all had chickenpox. And they would all ask me, how come you never got the chickenpox? And it's because I was lucky enough to have been vaccinated. And even today, whenever I tell my friends that I never had the disease, they're all very surprised. But it's just because I was vaccinated. And in response to the previous caller about her holistic approach and building natural immunities through herbs and remedies, there's so much that we don't understand about our body's natural germ population that it's kind of arrogant to try and say that, well, if you take so many of these herbs and so many of these spices, you'll start to develop an immunity to a certain disease. Well, I think that that's a rather arrogant position to take when we're just starting to realize how big of an effect and what kind of cultures in our stomach have an effect on our entire well-being. And so I think that I'm just every day very thankful that I haven't had any of these diseases. I mean, chickenpox doesn't sound like a good time. I had sore legs for a couple of days around the injection sites, and that was about...
And you were done with it. Yeah. David, we've got it. I appreciate your perspective. Stephen Salzberg, you're our professor of biostatistics here. Where are we headed on the trend lines that we're riding right now on vaccination rates and outbreaks? Where are we going?
Well, if we don't turn it around and get vaccination rates back up, we're going to continue to see outbreaks of previously controlled diseases indefinitely. We really, in order to, this notion of herd immunity might not be intuitive to people, but the idea is that if an infectious disease gets into one person, then if the people around that person are immune, then there's nowhere for that germ to go, that virus or bacterium when the person coughs or whatever. There's nowhere for that germ to go to infect anyone else. So it's controlled because the population isn't susceptible. And once you get above just a few percent, 4 or 5% of people susceptible, that's enough for these infectious diseases to start spreading around. And so we're at that point in some communities now, and we need to get it back. And these diseases could go away again, but if we don't change our permissive policies about letting so many people opt out, I'm afraid that we're going to see more and more outbreaks that will get larger.
States are looking at tightening up those policies to make it a little tougher, at least require some education or something. But there's pushback on that. We heard a little before and from our callers, and here's more. This is some Barbara Lee Fisher, Lowe Fisher, is president of the National Vaccine Information Center, again, anti-vaccine group. She talked with the doctors in 2012 about why, she said, parents should be able to choose opt-out on vaccines.
The human right to informed consent to medical risk-taking is what keeps the practice of medicine honest and ethical. And the truth is that vaccines, like prescription drugs, carry risks that can be greater for some than others because we're not all the same biologically. And that's why the government has paid out more than $2 billion to children and adults who have been injured by government-mandated vaccines.
Okay, a couple of things there. First of all, what's the $2 billion she's talking about, Paul Offit, in
Right. So there is in place in this country something called the National Vaccine Compensation Program, it is a series of lawyers that make decisions about whether or not they think vaccines caused harm. I think that those decisions are irrelevant. I don't think that
relevant or irrelevant.
Irrelevant.
Why? If we paid out $2 billion, it sounds like a lot of harm.
Because I think scientific or medical truths aren't determined in a courtroom. I think courtrooms are simply a place to settle disputes. If you want to determine whether or not a vaccine caused harm, what you do is you do a scientific study to see whether or not one is at greater risk of having a particular side effect if they've gotten a vaccine, if they haven't. So for example, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has compensated a woman for having multiple sclerosis within a period of time of receiving a hepatitis B vaccine, where there are abundant data to show that hepatitis B vaccine doesn't cause multiple sclerosis. So I don't think we should look to the courts to try and determine scientific truths. I think at the heart of this is Barbara Lowe Fisher's notion that it is your inalienable right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection. And I don't think that's true. We have 300 million people in this country, several hundred thousand of whom can't get vaccinated. They can't get vaccinated because they're getting immunosuppressive therapy for their cancers or their rheumatologic
disease. And so they are vulnerable.
They're vulnerable, and they're the ones who are most likely to be hurt. Do we have any responsibility to care for them? Are we in any sense responsible for our neighbor? I think the answer to that question is yes, and we're responsible to our children. I think, you know, frankly, under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which is the equal protection part of that amendment, I think children have an equal right to protection under the laws. And if their parents have an unusual belief that puts them at risk for these vaccine-preventable diseases because they choose not to get them, I think the state has a right to stand up and protect those children.
She says we're not all the same biologically in that statement, and so don't treat us that way. Vaccines do, you know, it's one size fits all pretty much. Is that what's going on here? People aren't willing to see themselves maybe correctly as just...
I disagree with that. I think that it's not a one-size-fits-all schedule. To look at the schedule, there are many, many precautions and contraindications based on a person's medical history. And the studies that are done of these vaccines include tens and tens of thousands of people pre-licensure and hundreds of thousands to millions of people post-licensure to try and answer the question, is this vaccine what it's claimed to be? Is it as safe and effective as it's claimed to be? And the answer to those questions are invariably yes, or else they would come off the market.
Dylan in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I have just one comment to an earlier caller that kind of speaks to what you're just talking about. I have two young children, both of whom we vaccinated, and I myself was vaccinated as a younger child. And I feel that the people who do not perform the vaccinations, do not get their children vaccinated, are doing so at the benefit of them. But our children, 98% of the kids, 95% of the kids, do get these vaccines, do get vaccinated. And maybe the holistic healers and such are not getting their diseases because of the benefit. Now, the burden that we're shouldering by doing this work, by getting taking these vaccines, and, they're not basing their findings on science or their reason. They're saying, well, we were holistic, we didn't get sick. But it's because society as a group took on this burden to develop these vaccines, to vaccinate our children, vaccinate our population, and they're reaping the benefits without becoming part of the solution.
You feel like they're free riding on your effort in a way. She has her concerns, their concerns. Dylan, I appreciate your call. I mean, Stephen, we've seen the autism rate in this country really go up. The numbers of much higher, and that and other things have people kind of freaked out. They're looking for answers here and maybe not willing to see themselves as part of that communal. They're thinking about my child, my circumstance, my risk. What turns that around, Stephen?
Well, in autism in particular, and I'm involved in some of that research at Johns Hopkins, It's clear that there are many more diagnoses of autism. We actually don't know, and the evidence doesn't really support that there's really an increase in the rate of autism as opposed to an increase in just the rate at which we're diagnosing it. But nonetheless, there are many people who are being diagnosed with it, and we're looking very hard for the real causes of autism, and it looks like it's really more than one disease, and there's probably multiple causes, and some of it is genetic. When you blame vaccines for it, which was blamed in the study 15 years ago, that was looked at. That's not the answer. And spending time re-examining that question is time that you could otherwise spend, valuable time you could otherwise spend looking for the true cause of autism. So I certainly wouldn't tell someone not to worry about what's causing autism, and that I certainly would emphasize we should do more to study it and figure out the cause and possible treatments for it. But vaccines are simply not the cause. We've studied that to death, and so it's a real waste of resources to revisit that question again and again.
Paul Offit, we've got 20 seconds for you here. There's a young parent out there listening right now with a couple of young kids trying to figure out what to do. What do you say, sir?
I say when they come into my office, I say, let me love your child. Don't ask me to put them in a position where they're going to be going out into a world that is becoming progressively more dangerous. Don't ask me to delay or space out or separate vaccines when that is going to do nothing but other than increase their risk of getting a vaccine-preventable disease. Please let me love your child, and vaccines provide that love.
Paul Offit, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases, Director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Offit.
Thank you.
Stephen Salzberg, Johns Hopkins University Professor of Medicine and Biostatistics. Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.